This is podcast number 123 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today, the story of Mary Washington, mother of George. Several years ago, when I was at the very beginning of this well-educated heart journey, as I was learning about the power of stories, I went to my local Barnes & Noble in search of some books that would inspire my grandchildren. I went back to the children's section and asked the salesperson for some help. I told her I was looking for some books that would be ennobling and would teach moral truths. She took me to the back wall where we scanned book titles together. She shifted from one foot to another, scratched her chin, and finally reached over and pulled out If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, and said, "I'm pretty sure this has a moral." Now, I love If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, but it wasn't quite the depth I was going for. I thanked her and asked her to show me the biography section, that maybe I could find something there. I was disappointed to see it occupied only a couple of small lower shelves, and most of the books were about current celebrities. But I did find a little section on George Washington, and thought I couldn't go wrong there. So I pulled out the first book, opened a page, and read this. What finally can we say about George Washington? The first thing is that he was no man of marble. He sometimes lost his temper, he was quick to jump into battle, he liked nothing better than a day spent on horseback, followed by a jolly dinner with friends and family. But George Washington had a passion for what was in those days called fame. Today people become famous for being good athletes, well-known musicians, popular actors. In Washington's time, fame meant something like lasting honor. A person could not become famous simply because he could hit a baseball far or sing in a popular style. He or she had to do something that was really important to a nation or the world. Washington believed that if he helped to found a great nation, he would earn undying fame. Seriously? Fame was his motive? How about what he said? "I was summoned by my country, whose voice I can never hear, but with veneration and love." Okay, maybe not that book. I picked up the next one, opened it up, and read, "George Washington never liked his mother." I turned a few more pages. He wanted to go to sea, probably to get away from his mother. A few more pages. We know he didn't like his mother because he addressed all his letters to "Honored Madam." Really? I don't think I've been back to Barnes & Noble since, but what a treasure trove of inspiring stories I have found online in the old children's books written so long ago. So for today's sampler, let's take a look at a story about George Washington's mother, Mary, and see what you think. I see a woman of virtue, a virtue that was instilled into the soul of her son. The story was originally found in an 1892 book, The Mothers of Great Men and Women by Laura Holloway, but I included an adapted version of the story in Stories of Great Wives and Mothers in the Forgotten Classics Library. Here is the adapted version. Had the mother of Washington been associated with the daily life of her distinguished son after he reached man's estate, hers would have been a familiar historical character. As she was not, the world knows but the barest incidents of her life as compared with the knowledge of Washington's wife. Like the mothers of all great and earnest men, she was a praying woman. Her Bible was her constant companion, and its precepts were ever on her lips. A silent, serious woman she was, self-contained, self-respecting, and reserved. During the 46 years of her widowhood, she managed her household and farm without the assistance of any adviser, and reared her children to usefulness and honor, and saw them go forth into the world equipped for its work and pain. That they each and all revered her and sought her counsel in every emergency is sufficient testimony of her worth and ability. Mrs. Washington's lack of personal ambition and her constitutional reserve were qualities which prevented her from becoming popularly known to the public, even at a time when the people were eager for any opportunity to show her honor. But no demonstration was ever made in her behalf, and there is but one instance recorded when she appeared in public with her son. This was after the surrender of Lord Cornwallis, when Washington, accompanied by his sweet mother, many distinguished military men went to Fredericksburg. A grand ball was given in his honor, and the proud old mother was the belle of the evening, the observed of all observers as she passed from group to group, leaning on the arm of her happy son. The beautiful devotion of Washington to his mother endeared him to her neighbors and to the people of Virginia, and the honors that were paid him on that occasion were doubly sincere because they were a recognition of his worth, not alone as a patriot, but as a son. Mother and son were much alike in character, personal appearance, and conduct. Washington, in the most trying emergency of his career as commander-in-chief, did not display more self-control and courage than did his mother in hiding from her children for months and years the distressing fact that she was a sufferer of cancer. This circumstance it was that strengthened her resolve to live alone, which she did up to the last few months of her life, and her mode of life probably had much to do with prolonging her existence to the great age she attained. The last duty that Washington performed previous to leaving Virginia for the seat of war at the breaking out of the rebellion was to go to Fredericksburg and remove his mother from the country into the city where her married daughter was residing. He was unwilling to go away, leaving her on the farm, and to overcome her opposition, he knew that a personal appeal must be made. The prospects of a long war and the uncertainty of his return were shown her in their conversation. And when convinced that it was to add to his peace of mind when away, she consented and removed at once, leaving a competent man in charge of the farm, subject to her daily supervision. And supervise it she did every day of her life, riding about the fields, directing the planting and the gathering of crops, ordering repairs and buying supplies. She had what would not be termed an old-fashioned buggy and a gentle horse, and every morning both were before her door awaiting her. She lived out of doors the greater part of the later years of her life. Her children were grown and gone from her, and her eldest son was engaged in duties that exposed him more or less to constant danger and separated him almost entirely from her. It was wisdom in her so to live, and the disease that had very gradually come upon her was kept at bay for many years by her uniform, quiet, and peaceful life. Where another mother of less fortunate temperament would have found occasion for constant worry and anxiety in her son's prolonged absence and trying, if high, position, Mrs. Washington fretted not at all, and troubled no one with her hard experiences. She had great native sense, and she was strong of will and firm of faith, and her outlook on life was in consequence extended. As a child on her father's Virginia plantation, Mary Ball was trained religiously, and as she grew to womanhood, she became a church member, and all her associations were of a religious nature. The children of the early settlers of this country and their immediate descendants were strenuous advocates of church worship, and they gave of their means and their time to build meeting houses. The Sabbath was the day of all others most filled with important duties. All the week the colonists worked hard, and at the meetings on Lord's Day they met together and were companions in devotion. They learned the Bible and could repeat large portions of it. Mary Ball was, by reason of her careful rearing and her natural disposition, altogether fitted for the position of stepmother, which position she assumed when she became the wife of Augustine Washington, her father's friend and neighbor. She was 24 years old when she married, an age not considered very young in the day. The Washingtons were planters of considerable means in Westmoreland County, and the home to which Augustine conducted his wife was one of the most comfortable in that section of the country. In this pretty country home was born, on the 22nd of February, 1732, George, the first child of Mary and Augustine Washington. Six children were born to Mr. and Mrs. Washington, five of whom lived to maturity. It was a very religious household. Both father and mother were members of the Episcopal Church. Family prayers were said morning and evening. The Bible was read, and the servants of the household were always present. The mother instructed her children constantly on religious subjects, and as often as not, her reproofs were made in scriptural language. In this way, she inspired their hearts with respect, and impressed upon their unfolding minds the dignity and responsibility of a mother. Mr. Washington died at the age of 49 years, leaving to his wife the responsibility of rearing her young children, the eldest of whom was but a small lad. Mrs. Washington found little difficulty in bringing up her children. They were disciplined in obedience, and a simple word was her command. She was not given to any display of rage, but was steady, well-balanced, and unvarying in her mood. A relative and playmate of George in boyhood, who was often a guest in her house, says, "I was often there with George, his playmate, schoolmate, and young man's companion. Of the mother, I was 10 times more afraid than I ever was of my own parents. She awed me in the midst of her kindness, for she was indeed truly kind. I have often been present with her sons, proper tall fellows too, and we were all as mute as mice. And even now, when time has whitened my locks, and I am the grandparent of a second generation, I could not behold that remarkable woman without feelings it is impossible to describe." Whoever has seen that awe-inspiring air and manner, so characteristic in the father of his country, will remember the matron as she appeared when the presiding genius of her well-ordered household, commanding and being obeyed. Mr. Sparks, than whom there is no better authority, says, "It has been said that there never was a great man, the elements of whose greatness might not be traced to the original characteristics or early influences of his mother. If this be true, how much do mankind owe to the mother of Washington?" Mrs. Washington permitted her son to spend his holidays at Mount Vernon with his brother Lawrence, and there he was brought into contact with military men and naval officers. The martial spirit was always strong in the lad, and he was a careful listener to the conversations held in that home on the Potomac. Lawrence encouraged George in his desire to become a military man. An opportunity offered to secure for him a midshipman's position on a British man of war, and Lawrence urged Mrs. Washington to let him accept it. George also petitioned her, and the trial was a severe one to her. She refused finally, on the ground that there was no reason why her son, he was then 14 years of age, should be thrown out into the world and separated so far from his kindred. The professions she objected to also as one that would take her boy from her permanently. She could not bring herself to see that it was to his advantage to go to sea, and we may feel assured she made it the burden of many prayers. There was a neighbor of hers who was a friend of her stepson's, and this man, Mr. Jackson, at the request of Lawrence, went to see her regarding the matter. After visiting Mrs. Washington, he wrote to Lawrence as follows: "She seems to dislike George's going to sea, and says several persons have told her it was a bad scheme. She offers trifling objections, such as fond, unthinking mothers habitually suggest." Mr. Jackson, who rated his worldly judgment against a mother's intuition? His obtuseness in styling her an unthinking mother was sufficient to have made a woman of her strong sense distrust advice from such a quarter. Had she been persuaded against her will, her son's great future would have been marred, and the probabilities are that his career would have been a comparatively obscure one. In the archives of Mount Vernon may be seen a manual compiled by Mrs. Washington from Sir Matthew Hale's Contemplations, Moral and Divine, which she wrote out for her son, and which he preserved until the day of his death. It stands to reason that a son who heeded every other instruction would yield implicit obedience in a matter of so much importance, and it is an historical fact that he in after years alluded to it with expressions of gratitude to his mother for preventing him from taking a step that would have been unfortunate, if not fatal, to his future. It was not a great while after the circumstance narrated above that the French and Indian War broke out, and George Washington received his mother's consent and blessing when he made known his desire to go. From that time henceforth, he was with her only on occasional visits. When the war broke out, he paid her, as has been said, a visit before starting north to assume command. In the long years that passed before she saw him again, he wrote her repeatedly, and lost no opportunity to relieve her mind of anxiety concerning him. The lavish praises bestowed upon him by all who saw her hardly ever received any other recognition than a quiet reminder that Providence was ordering all things. For herself, she found her self-control in prayer, and much of her time was spent alone. The surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown was the auspicious event that hastened their reunion. A messenger was sent to apprise her of the fact, and as soon as possible, public duties were laid aside, and Washington visited her, attended by his staff. His presence in Fredericksburg aroused the enthusiasm of all classes. For the first time in 6 years, mother and son met, and it may be imagined that her heart rejoiced over the meeting. She was then over 70 years of age. On this occasion, the people of Fredericksburg gave a ball in his honor, and it was attended by a brilliant throng of military officers and foreigners. Washington presented the American and European officers to his mother, who regarded her with undisguised pleasure and astonishment. Tradition says she was the picture of beautiful simplicity, moving among the dazzling throng dressed in the appropriate costume of a Virginia matron of the olden time. At the close of the Revolution, Washington endeavored, as he had done before, to have his mother reside with him at Mount Vernon. She was now past 70, and he was unwilling that she should live alone at her time of life. Her children all shared this feeling. Nothing could shake her determination. Her reply was, "I thank you for your dutiful and affectionate offers, but my wants are few in this life, and I feel perfectly competent to take care of myself." Very often Washington visited her, and always with increasing anxiety. During the latter portion of her life, when the pitiless disease from which she had suffered for years was making rapid headway, it was her habit to repair daily to a secluded spot near her dwelling, and there commune with her Maker. She sought by this means to gain strength to live out her days without harrowing the feelings of others with the sight of her sufferings. But for this disease, cancer in the breast, which had exhibited itself years before, she would in all probability have lived with her son, or at least her daughter. But as long as she could hide the cruel secret from her children, she did, and it was not until the last years of her life that her son knew of it. His alarm and anxiety she quieted by her resolute course, and her own courage and calmness helped the others. When Washington was elected President of the United States, he paid her a farewell visit. He was soon to start for the seat of government, and he felt that he would not see her again. This was the year of her death, and she knew when she gave him her last blessing that the end was not far off. The separation was intensely painful to him. He rested his head on her shoulder while she folded her feeble arms about his neck. Both wept, the mother silently, while Washington, unable to control his feelings, sobbed as she gently released herself from his embrace. She bade him to do the duty Providence had assigned him, and live his life through with her blessing on his head. The trial was bitter to her, because she was fast hastening away and would have gladly had his loving support to the end. But it was not to be, and controlling herself with great effort, she met the parting with more composure than he could summon. After intense sufferings, she died on the evening of the 25th of August, 1789, in her 83rd year, and the 46th of her widowhood. Mrs. Lewis, after the last sad rites were paid her, wrote to Washington informing him of the end. He had been extremely ill, and the intelligence deeply affected him. His letter included the following: "My dear sister, under these considerations and a hope that she is translated to a happier place, it is the duty of her relatives to yield due submission to the decrees of the Creator. When I was last in Fredericksburg, I took a final leave of my mother, never expecting to see her more." Mrs. Washington's business integrity throughout her life was one of her finest characteristics, and in her last worldly transaction she recorded the fact that her estate was encumbered by no debts. She died as she had lived, a grand character, one of the noblest this country ever has produced or ever will produce. Her grave was unmarked even by headstone until the year 1833, when the cornerstone of a monument to her memory was laid by President Jackson in the presence of a great concourse of people. The day, the 7th of May, was beautiful, the soft spring air and cloudless sky making it seem the perfection of weather. The grave was made near the spot where she was accustomed to retire and pray, and it recalled the memories of her last years to very many who stood on ground consecrated by her presence. The simple but eloquent inscription it contains is, "Mary, the Mother of Washington." Mrs. L. N. Sigourney's poem and tribute read on the occasion contains the following touching lines. "A nation's liberty and earth's applause, making Mount Vernon's tomb a Mecca haunt for patriot and for sage, while time shall last. What part was thine? What thanks to thee are due? Who, mid his elements of being wrought with no uncertain aim, nursing the germ of godlike virtue in his infant mind, we know not. Heaven can tell. Rise, noble pile, and show a race unborn who rests below, and say to mothers what a holy charge is theirs, with what a kingly power their love might rule the fountains of the newborn mind. Warn them to wake at early dawn and sow good seed before the world doth sow its tares, nor in their toil decline, that angel bands may put the sickle in and reap for God and gather to his garner." Bye-bye. See you next time.